Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian news coping mechanism, brought to you by the best damn political magazine on the planet. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Sudeman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy August to everyone.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Can I also say happy birthday, Matt Welch?
Yeah.
You can. I don't feel more than a day over 54, Nick.
Wow. Which, by the looks of you, might not be that far in the future.
And it's much worse on the inside. I can testify. All right. Are you ready, world? This is, quote, the week that could transform Biden's presidency, unquote. So says CNN. I'm taking the under. The transformation agent in question is the Jason in the Halloween movie franchise style shock return last week of Biden's long dormant Build Back Better bill. Now brazenly rebranded, if in better for my pronunciation needs, as the Inflation Reduction Act, with the help of West Virginia Senator, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. This will somehow also be the most ambitious climate policy bill ever passed. It will finally deliver on having Medicare negotiate drug prices. It'll increase taxes on corporations, jack up IRS collections to levels never before contemplated, or so it is all being sold right now by Democrats against the backdrop of an economy officially in a recession with inflation levels not seen in 40 years. We are going to discuss here on this podcast whether this back from the dead bill would deliver on some of these promises. But first, to tee us up, Sudeman, within a reasonable time frame, can you tell us what's in this damn thing?
I mean, the answer to that question is no, right? Like, it is not possible to convey what is in this damn thing in a reasonable time frame, but Sudeman will do his best.
Totally appreciate Catherine starting the Interrupt Olympics.
Yeah.
On a strong note. Go, Peter.
So in the world of video games, there's a term that gets used.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Woo.
This is how it's going to be, folks.
Do it.
Spiritual successor. And so a spiritual successor is like a sequel that's not a sequel. And so for video game nerds, The Outer Worlds was a spiritual successor to Fallout New Vegas. Basically, it's like, if you liked this previous game, this new game has a bunch of the same mechanisms and ideas, even if it's not technically being branded as number two or number three in the series. This is a spiritual successor to Build Back Better. It is a bunch of the stuff that was in Build Back Better, just reconfigured a little bit under the guise of it's going to fight inflation. There are three big components to this bill: healthcare, climate, and taxes. So the taxes part is they're going to give the IRS a whole bunch more money to dig into your finances, and they're also going to basically raise the corporate tax through a sort of backhanded manner called the book minimum tax. The climate provision, they're going to spend just a little less than $400 billion on a bunch of subsidies for a bunch of stuff. And then healthcare, they're going to spend a bunch of money on extending the increased subsidies for Obamacare that were part of the partisan bill, the American Rescue Plan that passed at the beginning of Biden's presidency. So that's going to be extended for a few more years out. That is primarily going to help people who make, you know, in the $100,000 to $150,000 range, or I should say households with incomes in the, you know, sort of low six-figure range there. And so this is a healthcare, climate, and taxes bill that is being branded as an inflation reduction bill. And I guess I am just a little bit skeptical about the inflation reduction part of this, since that seems to be the important part for Joe Manchin. He's been out there saying, well, look, inflation, it's a big problem. It's a big problem. Obviously, it's a big problem. We've seen inflation rates at the highest level in 40 years here. Joe Biden has said that reducing inflation is mission number one for him. But if you look at the Penn-Wharton budget model, which is like a pretty serious macroeconomic simulator that a lot of folks use to test whether these things, you know, what the effects of these things are going to be, here's a quote: "The impact on inflation is statistically indistinguishable from zero between now and 2031, and the real any impact at all doesn't really start until like 2027, and even then, it's basically indistinguishable from zero for the rest of the decade, more or less." And so this is better understood not as an inflation reduction bill, but as a Democrats solving their internal political problems bill. And that's why you have this collection of things. So climate is there because the climate activists are real mad. Like, they're so mad that congressional Democratic staffers are picketing Schumer's office, or have been for the last couple of weeks. It's hilarious, right? They've actually just, like, they've decided to become an activist group within the Democratic staffer establishment. The taxes stuff is there because Democrats need to raise taxes on the rich. The closest thing to outreach to, like, non-Democrats that you have are the healthcare provisions. But the healthcare provisions are still just there to solve political problems. In particular, the Obamacare subsidies. Democrats are not even pretending that there is another reason besides the political reason. The way the initial subsidy expansion was structured, the expanded subsidies run out right before the election. And so people were going to see increased premiums in Obamacare right before going to the voting booths in November of this year. And so this is all about trying to solve Democrats' political problems and doing a bunch of stuff that they already wanted to do. And because people are mad about inflation, they're calling it the Inflation Reduction Act.
Thank you, Peter, for your succinctitude. That was very good. Catherine, I'm going to read you a headline. I might insert a bracket into it, and then we'd like to get your reaction. Yeah. So all eyes turn to Catherine Mangu Ward, super libertarian, not quite gal pal, Kristen Sinema, as Democrats face a week that could transform Biden's presidency. That was from CNN's Stephen Collinson. But actually, what I really want to do is read you the lead paragraph and see if I can get any reaction noises from you, Catherine. Here we go. Democrats this week have the chance to validate their monopoly on political power in Washington, create a legacy of true significance for President Joe Biden, and even boost their hopes in daunting midterm elections in 3 months.
Can you do like an
I'm meditating my way through that.
For the folks who are not in the recording booth here, she is making the face.
I really try to keep it together. I read that whole article this morning, actually, and it doesn't get better from there. Absolutely every single paragraph is framed in the most, like, crappily tendentious way you could possibly imagine, all hinged on Sinema. But also, the author of the piece has no information about what Sinema is or isn't thinking, about what she might or might not do. So it is a content-free piece of ridiculous invective. You know, it's a healthcare bill. It's a climate bill. It's somehow also an inflation reduction bill. And I'm kind of skeptical. And while we have discussed many times on this podcast that all politicians will disappoint you and are garbage in the end, I got to imagine that Sinema's previous stance, which has been quite sensible on many of these things, hasn't changed. I actually, in that same piece, there was the one reasonable cluster of sentences in that piece was from Pat Toomey, which tells you when things are bad, in which he notes that the bill has a corporate tax increase. It's going to slow down growth. It's going to make the recession worse. And, you know, the prescription drug price controls are going to slow down drug development. And also there's a subsidy for wealthy people buying Teslas. Like, that's a good list of why this bill blows and why, I suppose, Sinema, who is in a position to block it, might well block it. I do also think, though, maybe like just COVID is going to block it, right? The margin is so razor thin to do this absolutely enormous thing. Like, one person gets a positive COVID test and we're done here. So, yeah, I would like to live in a world where Sinema does not have to save us all, but we might live in a world where Sinema has to save us all, Manchin having fallen nobly in the course of his duty.
Nick, which of the kind of big core promises that President Joseph Robinette Biden the 12th has made about this strikes you as particularly implausible?
I liked in his written remarks that are up on the White House website, he refers to corporatinations instead of corporations.
Yes.
And I'm kind of
the White House had to stick him, which is amazing.
I want to, start living in a world where, I mean, again, it's like Idiocracy, you know, where we're just making stuff up now and pretending like that's the way it always is. Because I think by the end of the week, the sick noting a mistake in the text will be gone from the White House page. It's going to be, no, we always thought corporate donations were people, or not, you know. But yeah, for me, the big thing here, and to go to Peter's point, and I think this is fits into the cinema question as well. Joe Manchin is not principled. Joe Manchin is not wise. Joe Manchin is not anything other than a whore for the people of West Virginia, as he defines it. And what he got out of this bill was enough relaxation on the death of King Cole and everything that he stands dear for. And he's safe, so he can vote for it. The real question in terms of the politics of this is there something in there for cinema? All she needs is like a little bit of a bone that she can then be like, you know, it's not perfect, but hey, politics is politics, blah, blah, blah. Because nobody really cares about her in this context anyway. For me, the biggest problem is that this is not at all about inflation reduction. I'm not sure it should be at this point, but, you know, there are three ways historically and effectively that you fight inflation. One is by raising interest rates. One is by raising taxes. And one is by cutting spending, because what you're trying to do is to suck money out of the economy. And those are the three basic ways to do it. Politicians are never going to basically do raising taxes or cutting spending if they can avoid it in any meaningful way. This bill doesn't really do that. It does kind of give some teeth back to the IRS. It has a corporate income tax, which will fuck the economy while not actually raising as much money as is projected. And that's all down the road anyway. They're not going to cut spending significantly. And, you know, it doesn't seem as if the Fed is going to raise interest rates in the way that it did in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan gave a wink and a nod to Paul Volcker at the Fed, where, you know, we saw interest rates triple in short order and get, you know, get up to like 20%. So that's, for me, is the biggest bullshit here. You know, we've done a bunch of videos on inflation, on the causes of them and the cure for them. Milton Friedman famously said inflation always and everywhere is a monetary phenomenon. He's not actually right about that. Sometimes it's a supply hink and things like that. And there's no discussion here in any of the political discourse about fighting inflation, of bringing the economy back online more quickly and more smoothly by doing things like getting rid of regulations, letting supply grow as fast as possible. So for me, that's the biggest problem.
We should talk a little bit about the corporate tax.
I was going to ask you about that, if you would have let the moderator speak.
Great.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, it's just fascinating. The reason the corporate tax is in here in the particular way that it is in, that it is structured not as a direct increase in the corporate tax rate, but as a new alternative tax, a 15% minimum tax on corporate book income. And so there's an analysis by the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a part of Congress. They do the tax analysis for Congress, that says that about half, 49.7% of that tax is going to fall on manufacturers. What's really, really funny is that this thing came out the exact same week that Congress passed a $280 billion subsidy bill designed to subsidize U.S. manufacturing. So on the one hand, they're saying, here, we're going to subsidize a bunch of things that we think are, you know, microchips and all of that stuff. And on the other hand, they're going to say, actually, we're going to pass a new tax that's going to tax a bunch of that money back. And then, of course, the way that that tax works is corporations don't actually... Yeah, it's not quite true that they don't pay taxes, but they are much more like tax collectors than they are like taxpayers, because they just fold those costs into the costs of their product. And so because of the new book minimum tax, this sort of backhanded, you know, implicit corporate tax increase, the JCT also estimates that people making between $0 and $200,000 a year and $200,000 and $500,000 a year are going to pay more in taxes as a result, which means that Biden's promise that no one who makes under $400,000 a year is going to see a tax increase is not really true. Now, it is true that those people are not going to have an increase in their income tax percentage, right? It's not going to be a rate increase. But according to the JCT, the whole point of this is that those people end up paying more taxes, both because of the book tax and then also because of the new funding for the IRS, which is designed for the IRS to go in and look at people's returns and find ways to make people pay more.
Speaking of that IRS new funding, that was in last year's version of this bill and other discussions, $80 billion increase, which is a huge, very significant increase in the IRS budget over the next 10 years. And it was billed as, we're going to finally close the tax gap, which is one of those evergreen, right up there with Medicare waste, fraud, and abuse. Mm-hmm. We're gonna get it this time. Really are. As Liz Wolf wrote in a piece last week, the provision in the bill about this, fulfilling the promise, as Joe Biden said in his corporate donations thing, is going to make the largest corporate donations in America pay their fair share without any new taxes on people making under $400,000 a year. Okay, so now let's go to the text in the bill. The text says, nothing in this subsection is intended to increase taxes on any taxpayer with a taxable income below $400,000. Our intentions are right there. So I'm sure it's not going to happen because our intentions are great. That's just fantastic. This is the second consecutive Democratic-run administration making promises about we're not going to not even a single dime or a nickel are we going to increase taxes on anyone making under $400,000 a year. That's just absolute abject BS. Catherine, so the CNN article that raised your blood pressure to almost Matt Welchian levels is part of, I think, a kind of growing trend. Sort of the desperation is showing, at least among the subsection of the media, doing the, well, actually, Biden has had a really successful presidency. Look at all the stuff he's done out there. Is it, are we being overly libertarian-y, cynical? Maybe he has had a fateful and large and successful presidency and we're just looking in the wrong way? Is the kind of desperation showing, or both?
The desperation is so manifest that I am confident in it, even through the veil of my own cynicism. Like, it's ridiculous. The idea that they are now here at the end of their partisan monopoly on power in Washington.
The presumptive end.
Almost. I mean, yes, I, as we know, have, despite being a political journalist, fully gotten out of the business of predicting elections since Donald Trump's election. I don't do it. So, okay. But they are jamming every single agenda item that he ran on into one big dumb bill that is still not as big or, frankly, as dumb as they hoped it would be in this kind of, oh my God, the semester's over cram session nightmare situation. And like the key person in their study group, the key person in their group project is Kyrsten Sinema. So it's not going to go great for them because she's not even sure this project idea is a good one. And maybe she wants to start over and think about whether we should even be in this class at all. She's taking this class pass fail. She is not invested, and like rightly so, because it's a dumb class. Okay, I'm sorry the metaphor got out of hand, but it's totally desperate. And the CNN article, which truly people should read. I mean, it's just a random piece by Stephen Collinson. All eyes turned to Sinema, as Matt read, but it gives away the whole game, including that randomly in the third paragraph of this article, we have the fight over the healthcare funding for veterans who are sick from exposure to pit burns during America's wars. And y'all may have developed a better filter for stuff that Jon Stewart says than I have at this point, but somehow he got through my blocks. And I saw him shouting about how it was the cruelty. The cruelty is the point, right? We're back to that. The idea that somehow suddenly it's really important to talk about how Republicans are recreationally cruel to veterans right now is, again, just like an absolutely desperate move.
So you're objectively pro burn pit.
Yeah, that you got me, Suderman. You and Jon Stewart together got me. The whole thing is ridiculous. And it is why partisan politics have turned so many people off and why nothing does get done, in part because, you know, you look at these jokers and you're like, I'm not going to go all in for these guys. I'm not going to back what they want to do.
Let's do a round robin of individual things that are in this bill that might have escaped attention or that are particularly interesting, comical, or just trivial to the extent that we have all done our homework. I was reading the federalnewsnetwork.com, as one does.
FNN?
I think so. I'm not sure. Just this sentence, which neither here nor there, but it made me laugh. The bill would also give the Postal Service $3 billion to purchase electric vehicles and charging infrastructure. Thank you, Joe Manchin. Nick, is there anything else that in this bill that strikes you as interesting, underreported, mirthful, et cetera?
Two things. One was it does not include tax credits for electric bikes, which set off electric bike Twitter, which somehow managed to worm its way through my copious defenses against it.
And those bikes are expensive. Have you ever priced out one of those?
Don't you dare tell me that only rich people, you know, use them as their eighth and ninth vehicle, Peter Suderman. They are absolutely central to the flourishing of America's underclass. That's what I learned when I said it's like I was kind of amazed that electric bike Twitter was, you know, all upset about this. But the other one that I think is even more characteristic of the big one of the big problems that we have, if everything goes according to plan, households making up to 400% of the poverty line will qualify for Obamacare subsidies. And it's like, at what fucking point do we tell people you make enough money to fucking pay your own way?
So, Nick, I actually want to correct you just a little bit on that. The original Affordable Care Act, the one that was passed, you know, in 2010, included subsidies for people making up to 400% of the poverty line, which is about $105,000 a year for a family of four right
now.
It's
really, you know, that's nothing. If you are living in the richest town in America and going to the most expensive schools, making $105,000, it's nothing.
And that created a problem for Obamacare, which was that if you made $110,000 a year, you didn't qualify for any subsidies and had to pay the actual price of the insurance for your Obamacare insurance. So in the American Rescue Plan, which is the $2 trillion bill that Biden and Democrats passed right after Biden became president, they said, actually, we're going to uncap this. There's no longer a cap, and no one, regardless of your income, has to pay more than 8.5% of your income for health insurance. And that meant that people making, in some cases, up to something like $350,000 a year would at least theoretically qualify for health insurance subsidies. The actual primary effect of this, though, is to help people making 400 to 600% of the poverty line, which is up to about $159,000 a year. And the AARP extended that for 2 years. And then what this bill does is it extends it for another 3 years, you know, at which point inevitably there will be a push to extend this even further. And it was amazing when Obama gave a speech earlier this year about like Obamacare after 12 years or whatever. He was like, you know, Obamacare is pretty great, but there's one big problem with it, which is that without these expanded subsidies, you know, the ones that weren't in the original bill that we called Obamacare that I passed, this is just way too expensive. Nobody can afford this stuff. And it's like the bill is called the Affordable Care Act. And you're literally saying the whole problem with it, there's just one little thing, is it the healthcare isn't affordable. And it's also, it's just crazy that like their idea that they're going to help people with inflation with tens of billions in subsidies by pumping a bunch of extra money into the economy. So even if you want to accept the argument that because this bill raises taxes and is theoretically on net a deficit reducer, it is on net anti-inflationary. Even if you accept that argument, this provision on its own is inflationary. And so at best, at very best, you can say that these are inflationary provisions included in the context of a maybe, maybe, if we're lucky, anti-inflationary bill that actually probably isn't anti-inflationary at all, at least not in the time period that we care about.
The large point, thank you, Peter, for the technical discussion, is one of the reasons we're in the problems that we are in is because nobody feels like they should pay for anything anymore. And instead of having a government which is smaller and nimbler and more effective and more focused on helping people who actually might need it, it's all about just how do I get my free stuff? And that doesn't end well.
It also says that, and Biden reiterated this in his remarks, that this is, of course, like everything, a deficit reduction bill. All the numbers of this bill absolutely depend on incredibly exaggerated notions of how much more money, tax money, the IRS is going to collect. My people, I'm telling you right now that those projections always, I mean always, fall short, because the richest people who are supposedly the targets of this increased enforcement figure it out. They can afford the tax avoidance strategies. The people who take it in the shorts are the people who can't quite afford all of that muscle, and they don't make enough money to make those projections come true. So all of that talk is going to be happy nonsense. Catherine, what have you
specifically in the camouflage cargo shorts?
Thank you for recognizing my pain, Catherine.
Yeah, I just want to talk about the prescription drug part of the bill, because I think that if we're talking about larger scale civilizational threats from this bill, that might be one that we're overlooking. This bill would allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices essentially, or set them functionally. And I don't think in the end that it's going to be quite as dramatic as some of the propaganda, let's say, in favor of this bill is claiming. But I do think it's going to introduce a massive amount of additional uncertainty into a sector of our economy that is already nearly wrecked by regulatory risk. And that's not going to be good for anyone, because the U.S. is already carrying a lot of the burden of drug innovation. Not that we necessarily are doing the innovation here, but we are the market for expensive drugs, because we pay for expensive drugs in some form that in some way resembles something having to do with their cost to research, develop, and produce. That is increasingly not true everywhere else in the world. I don't want it to be true here. And there's just so much going on in this bill that we don't have time to think or talk about this provision at all, you know, to our detriment.
I will add two last points before we go to our listener email of the week. One is that Biden, in his remarks, said, and this is roughly the 12 trillionth time a president has said this, or candidate for president has said this over recent years, it's going to give us the ability not only to compete with China for the future, but to lead the world and win the economic competition of the 21st century. Stop it. All of you, just stop it. If you are a president of the United States and you're worried that we might lose a competition to China, resign. Just resign and shut up. Okay.
And you say I'm the anarchist.
I think Matt's just an agent of China.
Red China, Nick. The other thing is that Biden also says it gives folks rebates to buy new and efficient appliances, to weatherize their homes, and tax credits for heat pumps and rooftop solar. Joe Biden, under Obama, when he was vice president, literally led a weatherization task force. We were going to, it was going to be recovery through retrofit. That was happening in 2009, people. Stop trying to weatherize us. Maybe we don't want to weatherize at the end. We've weatherized enough. Damn it. All right. We're going to get to, I've decided that in my old age, I'm going to either turn into Nick or just become very, very cranky. We're going to get to our
false choice, my friend.
Well, I don't think you have the stomach for it, man.
I don't have the stomach. I don't have the chops, right? Yeah. That's a certain amount of fluency, which would be escape my ability there. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, ever get the feeling like somebody's watching you and you get no privacy there on the internet, even when you think you're being careful? Well, they are watching you. That is, unless you use protection like IPVanish VPN. IPVanish is a service that protects your right to privacy and helps you stay anonymous online. IPVanish enables you to browse safely without exposing your private information to third parties, whether they be advertisers, ISPs, or hackers. When you use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, or web-connected thingamajig, all of your data is encrypted. That means all your private details, passwords, communication, browsing history, Nick, physical location will be completely shielded and without sacrificing your speed. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It really is that simple. Roundtable listeners who act right now will receive an incredible 70% off their yearly plan, all with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's like getting 9 months for free. Just go to ipvanish.com/roundtable, use the promotional code roundtable, and take your privacy back right now. That's ipvanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, email your questions, queries, puzzlers, twizzle sticks to roundtable@reason.com. Include a pronunciation guide if you lack confidence in my ability. This one comes from a beloved listener, Andy Hawks, who did have confidence in my ability. I could do Andy and Hawks. He writes, "The New York Times has been running an I Was Wrong series by its opinion columnists, such as Paul Krugman being wrong on inflation, Michelle Goldberg on Al Franken, and David Brooks on capitalism. If Catherine were to have Reason editors write similar columns, what would the roundtable members write about? We don't have enough time for Nick. Catherine, that's a cheap shot. Catherine, I want you to lead us off.
Yeah, I first of all want to note that the thing that the New York Times opinion editors are wrong about is bringing back Nick Kristoff, which is happening. Like, they should write an unsigned editorial about how they were wrong to do that.
To have Thomas L. Friedman still.
Yeah. Oof. What I'm going to say here is not new, but I am still very sorry about how wrong I was. And so I will say it again. I was wrong about the Iraq War. Just wrong about it.
In the pages of Reason?
No, not in the pages of Reason. But in my life, that's probably the thing I've been most importantly wrong about, because I backed it from a libertarian, what I perceived to be a libertarian point of view. I really just thought, like, hey, I am a cosmopolitan libertarian. I am a utilitarian. And so we have this here military. And I am told that Saddam Hussein's really bad, maybe a global existential threat, and that we could, like, real quick and pretty cheap, free millions of people from his tyranny. And I was like, maybe we should try. Seems like we should try. That seems like a good deal. Wow. I was incorrect about that calculus, and I'm very sorry. I don't think my opinion about it mattered one fig. I think we were going to do it no matter what, because my opinion was shared by just a massively large percentage of the American public. But I was wrong. I was young, but I was a grown ass adult, and I should have known better.
That's sweet. Suderman, you're the same age, more or less. What did you get wrong?
I also got the Iraq War wrong, but
wow.
I mean, when I was 22, I was sort of skeptical, but I just had this assumption that, like, oh, people sort of in charge probably had information that I didn't have, and therefore, like, I shouldn't be, you know,
that's
questioning
the real
their, yes,
revelation of adulthood.
It really is.
They don't.
I have two quick ones, one that I think listeners will appreciate and one that listeners may not, or at least my fellow editors here. The one that I think people will appreciate is that, in retrospect, I think I was too willing to sort of accept some of the kind of public health bureaucracy consensus during, you know, the early months of, certainly the kind of medium early months of COVID, let's say not after the first 6 weeks, but 3, 4, 6, 8 months in, but before there was a vaccine widely available. I mean, I was looking for disconfirming evidence, and it took me a little while to find it because the studies took a little while to come out. In the future, I will lean even harder on my sort of priors there, because I think my priors ended up being right rather than, it was sort of, I assumed that if the entire international community and all of the experts in what seemed to be a real and genuine crisis were basically on the same page, that, like, there was probably knowledge that I didn't have access to that I needed to wait to sort of see. And once again, it was, you know, look, the vast majority of the experts were wrong, I think, and in ways that were pretty catastrophic. The one that people will be maybe a little bit more upset with me about is, I think I was wrong about Mitt Romney in some, and I was quite critical of Mitt Romney. And I think my technical policy criticisms of Mitt Romney were correct. But I think he actually would have been a much better choice than Obama in 2012, would have been better for the Republican Party, for the country, for the polity. And I look back and I think that I could have written about Mitt Romney a little bit differently, even though I'm not taking back any of my arguments about Romney care. I'm not taking back any of my arguments about Romney's absolute nonsense. Oh, we're going to cut government through waste, fraud, and abuse and, like, funding for PBS or something. All of that was right. But I still think that he would have been a better president, better for the country, better overall, better at handling the place that America was going to than the, you know, Obama-Trump succession that we ended up getting.
Mitt Romney is the person who caused me to have to look up the German word for, can you have nostalgia for something that you never had? And it's like, I feel like a weird, like, it's, I agreed with Suderman's criticisms at the time. I still think Romney is importantly wrong and also probably a bit of a douche, but oh my God, Romney's America. I long for it, even though we never had it.
Did you actually say that Obama would be better than Romney?
What I argued was that there was, from a libertarian perspective, no significant difference, and that Obama and Romney were two sides of the same coin. It was a Joker Batman situation, right? You complete me.
Oof, yuck. I mean, as always, the question of what a President Romney would have done on immigration for me is in many ways the deal maker or breaker in this hypothetical presidency and how I feel about it, because he's not good on that.
I want to be clear. When I say that I think I was wrong about Romney,
no,
I don't mean I think he would have been excellent and wonderful and praiseworthy in all ways. I think he actually would have been better, and I didn't admit or say that at the time.
Romney was one of the key architects in pushing the Republican Party to a much more aggressively restrictionist place, which is something that you won't read almost anywhere, but you will read in the pages of Reason magazine.
And it's also, you know, somebody who was either born and or lived a large chunk of his life in Mexico. It's always nice when people like that really shit on immigrants.
Nick, what are you copping to here?
You know, my big one, one is that I really expected the U.S. enabled toppling of Raul Cedras in Haiti. I thought that was going to be start like World War III. Obviously didn't happen.
Wow.
But that's
deep,
just, I mean,
deep
yeah.
Cut.
Yeah,
like
now a very, very deep
World
cut.
War III hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. No, but the big one, and this is an ongoing one, and it is one that I really want, like, libertarians variously defined to kind of think about, is I thought for virtually the entirety of my career at Reason that convincing people that, you know, kind of that government is the problem, government is inefficient at best and kind of evil or malevolent at worst, convincing people of that, that you cannot trust government, you cannot have confidence in government, is the precursor to creating a libertarian world. And I no longer believe that, because we have achieved that goal, according to Pew Research, in 1964, which is the first date that they have data for. 77% of people said that they can, you know, they trust the government to do the right thing most of the time. That percentage is now 20%. It's 20%. It has been below 30% historically since 2008. We have won that very libertarian argument that was echoed famously, you know, by Ronald Reagan when he ran for president in 1980, that government isn't the solution to your problems. Government is the problem. We have completely won that argument, and it has had no clear effect on reducing size, scope, and spending of government. If anything, government spending has continued to increase as we have less trust and confidence in it. I wrote a piece, I think it was in 2019, laying out what I think is going on here and, you know, observing, and this is certainly not an original insight, that political economists, political scientists, for years study, when you move from a high trust society to a low trust society, one of the things that changes is people demand, knowing that government is corrupt or evil or at worst, you know, just not efficient or effective, they demand more of it in all aspects of their lives. And I think we are living that libertarian nightmare where, yes, nobody trusts the government, and yes, we want more of it on every level. And there are ways to turn that around. But for me, that is a big revelation. And it's one that I want to own up to as much as possible, because I think flipping that, you know, ironically, you can have less government in times when people believe the government can actually get some stuff done.
My nomination early on in my Reason career, I expressed more enthusiasm than was warranted for the rise of free tabloid newspapers passed out in front of subways. But thankfully, no one remembers that.
Wow.
No one read that at the time.
Yeah.
So that's all fine. The biggest one is in 2015, 7 years ago, when Donald Trump controversially gave a last minute speech at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas. I reacted to it, wrote a piece about it called The Idiocracy Candidate. And I do not apologize for that title, because great. If totally obvious, I just wanted to be the first to use it. But for the following formulation. And this was sort of in reaction to him talking about Make America Great, which he was just then sort of trotting out as a line. The only thing Donald Trump will make greater in 2015-16, that's a total Gillespieism, by the way, is the exit velocity with which whole swaths of Americans will leave even the theoretical orbit of the Republican Party. Will even Cuban and Vietnamese Americans vote GOP in 2016 at this rate? Well, Matt Welch, they did in greater rate. Cubans, Vietnamese actually plummeted. They went from being two-thirds supported McCain to one-third supported Trump. So they vamooshed. But Cubans increased, and that was kind of important in the state of Florida, which was kind of important to the Trump's presidency. And in general, Trump encouraged more Republicans to vote for president than had voted in a really long time. I think more about the spirit in which I wrote that, which was basically, since I was here watching Donald Trump speak for an hour, then therefore I thought no one who does that, no one who sits through one of these speeches is ever going to conclude, oh, I would vote for that guy for president. I was so wrong about that. It changed the way that I think about journalism and writing and talking ever since, about the way that I make assumptions about people, about myself and how weird I am. All of it just like turned it on its ear. How are people consuming and expressing their consumer preferences in politics? And I think that it's kind of crazy for anyone who's involved in political journalism not to have had at least some crisis of the brain during the Trump era, not exactly in the same path, but in their own various ways. I think it's a big challenge, particularly to opinion journalism, because people treat, you know, their very august, you know, discussion of ideas and policies as being what we're all here for. And I don't think that the way people, voters express their preferences turned out to be about that. So it kind of exposed what we all do as being different or having different intent or audiences than we expected. And it's been an existential crisis, not as much as Catherine supporting preemptive war as a 12-year-old. But she really
was the difference maker.
I think she was.
Matt, so does that mean you're leaving Reason to become the PR guy for Eric Trump's exploratory bid for the 2028 presidency?
Andrew Yang, baby. It's just the forward party. If we just get a technocratic.
You want to see if Andrew Yang can alienate Asian voters as much as Donald Trump?
I just want to shout
I want to give him the potential to do that. Nothing is undoable.
I like Andrew Yang as a dude, just as a nice feller. And I know Nick has interviewed him and other people. But J.D. Tuchilli's headline on a piece from this morning is just a good headline. Whoever wrote this, if it's J.D., if it's the web editing staff, if it's Catherine Mangu Ward herself, another centrist project offers mushy technocracy to sue the divided country. That's a good headline. Go read.
Doesn't leave a lot left to read, though, does it? It's kind of like a trailer for a movie about a whodunit.
We've talked about this on this podcast, that theory of headline writing.
I agree. I'm a proponent. Perfect. I brought the idea of giving it all away in the headline, but like, I don't know. I think I would have liked to know that it's about Andrew Yang and like why Yang sucks in particular. I think I've read it already.
Like the idea of like 1998 headline being like, dang, Yang.
Yeah. Oh, it would have been. Yeah.
The comma in between.
Yang the drum slowly.
Forward pass? ? Or just something totally inscrutable.
Forward Follies. Oh my God, that's what it would have been called. Forward Follies. I will say, by the way, Matt, that was a Tuchilli authored headline. So full credit to the Tuch as always.
I think he should have used an Italian American slang word in there.
That's true.
Always.
Because living in the desert of Arizona, nothing is more, you know, Brooklyn than that, right? As a Dago.
Did I mention on this podcast that I was...
I'm protected.
We have one of those Alexa machines. Sorry, Catherine, that you named your child wrong. My youngest likes to have the transcripts of songs, right? The captions of the words, I guess you call them. And we were listening to something on the Grease soundtrack. You know, we come together, blah, blah, blah. And there's like some doo-wop in there. But they used a bracket in WAP, like not available or something like that to indicate that it was a slur. And my daughter's like, why are they cussing in Greece? They just assumed that WAP was an anti-Italian slur that we just can't have anymore.
Whole play is and the movie especially is a celebration of Italian-Americanness taking over the country.
That's where it all went wrong.
John Travolta's reign of terror was just beginning.
It was.
Between that and Saturday Night Fever and Welcome Back, Kotter, Italian-Americans never rode so high or as far.
It's the boy in the bubble started that, as you well know. Today.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Speaking of lousy Gillespie Welch 70s references, what have we all been consuming in the cultural arena? Nick, you got to go first.
Okay. So HBO is in a strong moment of just having tons of great stuff in there. And I don't want to give away other possible series in the future, but I've been watching The Rehearsal with Nathan Fielder. People might know him from his previous show, Nathan For You, which is a prank show where a kind of Asperger-y Canadian gives ridiculous advice to failing small business people and then films it, ultimately mocking himself more than anybody, I think. He was also an executive producer, helped with How To with John Wilson, which is also another kind of triumphant HBO series. But The Rehearsal is a show that I cannot summarize, but you absolutely must watch it. All of the summaries I read of it before I started watching it, and it's into its third or fourth episode now, I was like, this is terrible. Nathan Fielder was a 1.5 hit wonder. It is the ultimate kind of deconstruction of reality TV, of documentary realism, of Canadian identity. I'll throw that out there, as well as kind of bright boy, Asperger-y stereotype that's very much of the moment. It's a phenomenal show, and I expect it to end well as a dramatic series on HBO. And I suspect that Nathan Fielder's real life will become mired in tragedy. It's a tremendous show, The Rehearsal on HBO.
So it's like an ironic version of Property Brothers.
I think it's beyond ironic. I think it's like so far down irony, it's like you don't know anymore. It's just it's a great kind of nauseating, anxiety-inducing, cringe watch thing that everybody should take a look at.
You're selling it.
I got to tell you. I mean, it's you know, it's like it's indescribable and it's fucking great.
Sudeman, what did you consume?
I played the video game Stray on the PlayStation 5, because I finally got one. And it's a game in which you play a cat. And you do cat stuff. In a cyberpunk future, populated entirely by kind of sad robots who are scared of the little rat-like creatures called Zergs that run around outside their part of their city. Mostly the game is about kind of figuring out how to get around and like jump from this place to that place. Or it's a video game people will understand this. It's a platformer, but there's also elements of point and click adventure. These are other like video game terms for video game people. Because you like have to go and solve like little puzzles, but sometimes you have to solve them by doing cat things. And what's great is this game just allows you to kind of stop and randomly do cat stuff. Like anytime there's something soft, you can just press a button and curl up and take a nap. And it's not like this advances the gameplay most of the time. It's just like, oh, there's something soft. You're a cat. You might stop and take a nap. But sometimes you stop and take a nap, or you like scratch the thing hanging on the window, and you have to scratch it and keep scratching it so that it will go up so you can get through the window. And it's like, what's great is the way that it sort of incorporates catness into the gameplay. I spent a while reading about virtual reality for a piece that I wrote for a reason a couple of months ago. And one of the interesting factoids that I encountered was that virtual reality researchers in the 1980s realized pretty quickly that people could take on non-human avatars and learn to control them, even if they had extra limbs, even if they were like a lobster with a tail or something like that, because people are just like, ah, that's fine. Their brains just adapt to having a tail in virtual reality with surprising ease and adeptness. This is not a virtual reality game, but it is surprising how easy it is to adapt to being and thinking like a cat.
Catherine, do I have your permission to skip Peter next week on this segment of the podcast?
You do not.
Okay. Just had,
that's
had
really
to ask.
Unfair, Catherine. That's really unfair.
Had to ask. What to help us, Catherine, what did you do in your book club?
Catherine, you'd love the robots.
I'm not.
They're such great, sad robots. One of them just wants to find his dad.
Peter, I mean, just jump ahead. The litter box and the sex situation. Would you get that out of the way so
Please.
We never have to talk about it again?
So I watched the new adaptation of Persuasion because I am not a cyberpunk cat. And what happened was I went in thinking I was going to hate it, because Book Talk told me I was going to hate it. But then, oh my God, I hated it. It is one of the worst Austen adaptations of our time. It is Fleabag meets Bridgerton, but all the worst things about both of those shows. It is horrific. Anne Elliot, who is the heroine of the story, this is Austen's last complete novel, and she is an incredibly compelling character, I would say almost unique, even in Austen's oeuvre of fascinatingly written women. And she is turned into some kind of manic pixie dream Elizabeth Bennet variation of herself, in love with a goddamn himbo sailor. It is insupportable. I will not have it. It was so bad. So protect yourselves, Austen fans. Do not stream the new Persuasion on Netflix. It's winking and repurposed without being genuinely new. I hated it.
They also, my understanding is, like, used a lot of the ticks from Fleabag, which is great, but used them badly.
Yes, that's what I said.
You want to see Fleabag meets Bridgerton was actually produced by a major studio in the 70s. It's called Mandingo, and it features Norton and James Mason and Linda Day George.
But this is relevant to my interests because this is also apparently happening with the new She-Hulk show.
Oh my God. They like obliterated the fourth wall. They just like vomited on the fourth wall.
How do we go from Jane Austen to the She-Hulk?
Via Fleabag, obviously. Phoebe Waller-Bridge took us right there.
Fleabag is to like this generation of women, I feel like, what Fight Club was to my generation of dudes.
Tell me more, Peter.
And I would like to explain that to you.
In this essay, I will.
Thank you for coming to my TED.
I don't know. What that suddenly, about 20 years worth of demographic decline has just been cleared up for me.
It's the revelation. Speaking of decline, I participated in an event last afternoon that Nick Gillespie was at for the first several minutes. And that Peter
cameo Sutton, appearance.
It was an outstanding appearance.
I had 40 other events to helicopter in and out of, Matt.
I understand. And Suderman would have liked to have been there.
Yeah,
I do
great.
Believe. This was a mutual friend, had a birthday party and decided to do a pub crawl in mostly lower Manhattan of historic, ancient, claims to be the first pub or thereabouts bar in New York City. A crawl that was heroically emceed by one of the funniest and smartest tragic people on the planet, Bill Schultz, known to people probably mostly while he was the repulsive sidekick to Greg Gutfeld, that's so named, on the Red Eye program for 10 years or so on Fox. Before being summarily executed at some point. And he now is the co-host of Morning with Bill Schultz and Joanne Nosachinsky on Compound Media, which I'll be guesting on, I believe, on Wednesday. Go check it out if you can find it. Anyways, Bill is just this brilliant, crazy, funny repository of all kinds of strange and wonderful knowledge. And so we went to the Dead Rabbit. That's where we saw Nick, the Francis Tavern. So that's how it's spelled, not how it's pronounced, but I did it just to make Nick snort. The I think it's called the Old Town Pub, and then Pete's up around whatever the hell it is, Nick's neighborhood. But it was mostly there. It was mostly great just to hear Bill Stemwind about the what was the name of the movie? Gangs of New York. Mm-hmm. And the actual real characters that they could have included there, like ladies who sharpened their incisors on their teeth and had claws and just would, so that in fights they could lop off your ear and put it in a jar at the bar that they ran. This is all true, people. Incredible. And even though you can't go on that tour with Bill, a thing that you can do, at least if he ever wakes up from his hangover from last night and sends me the text, he has done a series on YouTube of him jogging to various historical sites in New York, including all these pubs, or most of them I've seen. He does a John Lennon tour. He does all kinds of disreputable like jogging tours with historical tidbits about New York that are just great and hilarious, just like Bill is himself. And can't recommend it highly enough. And hopefully we'll get you a good link on there. And just seek out Bill wherever he is, except if he's at a bar late at night, because then then someone's going to get an earlobe.
Then avoid him.
Strongly second that recommendation for the Dead Rabbit, one of the best bars in New York, and a great cocktail program there. They consistently win, you know, best bar in the world type awards.
Wait, last time I went there, you're falling for experts again, Peter?
I'm just saying they are widely recognized, and I've been there a couple of times. It's fantastic. It is, fun fact, Stephanie Slade's favorite bar. The last time I went there, I had some sort of crazy sour thing that was plum and cognac. And I thought that there was sort of a misprint on the menu because it said plum cognac or something like that. And I was like, well, that how did you get both of these things? And there's supposed to be a comma here. And they were like, no, we used a centrifuge to incorporate plum into cognac and then use that as the base of the cocktail. And yet the cocktails don't feel like super, this doesn't feel like a pretentious. The drinks don't, it doesn't feel like you're sort of at some place that like is condescending to you with their drinks. It's just, it's super fun and wonderful and, but incredibly delicious.
And hard to get a table on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah. I had to reserve well in advance to get some booths way in the back, but it was great. Shout out to everybody who was involved. All right. That's all the time we have for here on this particular Reason Roundtable podcast. You can listen to all of our podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and also the Reason Rundown with Dr. Peter Suderman. He got a doctorate when you weren't looking, in which he explores topics with various Reason staffers about the stuff that they've been deep diving on. And it's super great. Check it out. You can check out all those things at reason.com/podcasts. If you wish to donate and encourage our efforts, go to reason.com/donate. Very, very helpful. And we love each and every one of you in general. Okay. We will see you next week. And thank you. Goodbye.